I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Matthias Thaler, professor of political theory at the University of Edinburgh. We're discussing his recent book, No Other Planet, Utopian Visions for a Climate-Changed World, from Cambridge University Press. Thaler works on contemporary political theory, particularly theories of violence and the imagination. He has published several articles and books on these topics.
Well, first of all, Matthias Thaler, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks so much for the invitation, Jeffrey. I'm really excited to talk to you about my book.
Well, and I love this book, Matthias. It's a great analysis of a lot of great thinking, contemporary thinking, past thinking on utopia, and some really interesting interpretation of some very cool sci-fi books, which I'm very excited to talk about some of these. So good job on the book. Let me first of all ask you, what was the motivation for writing this book in the first place?
So I had just finished my book before, which is called Naming Violence, in which I tried to understand the place of the imagination in contemporary political theory. And after having finished the first draft of the book, I realized there was a very big aspect of the imagination that I hadn't really touched upon in this book. And that was the utopian imagination. And instead of just adding yet another chapter to the book there, I thought I'm going to try to publish this book first and then embark on the next project on the radical imagination as it becomes expressed in utopian thinking and acting. And by chance, I had a sabbatical leave then and spent that sabbatical leave basically really engaging in depth with questions of utopianism. And that allowed me to combine my interest in what I think is the biggest challenge humanity is facing right now, namely the intertwined climate and biodiversity crisis, with my interest in the radical imagination. And that's how the book came about in some broad sense.
That's good. So can we start maybe by just, with a very simple question. What is utopia? What do you mean by it? I mean, it's one of these terms that I think it's often used in contemporary parlance, but means many different things to many different people. There's a long tradition of utopia from Thomas More onwards. So how do you understand utopia?
Yeah, that's a very good place to start with the conversation, I think. And the first thing to say in response is, of course, as you already pointed out, it's an idea and a concept with a very long history and a very long history of heavy contestation around the very meaning of the term itself. And I explain that by working through two very, I think, common strands of criticism of utopia first. So the first criticism of utopianism sees it primarily as a form of daydreaming, right? So that's in the common, perhaps, language sense of utopianism as a form of daydreaming. And the criticism then is frequently that utopians are engaged in deeply escapist forms of imagining other worlds. And that's problematic because we need to really grapple with the reality here and now. So that's one form of criticism that I try to engage with in the book. The other criticism, indeed, is the opposite in some ways, namely that utopias can also become totalitarian. In some sense, the challenge here is that the problem with utopianism is that it seduces an audience into believing in the actual realizability of this other world, and thereby belittles the sacrifices that would have to be made to inaugurate this beautiful Arcadian future. Now, these are very, I think, well-established challenges to utopianism. They tap into, I think, some pretty important objections to social dreaming more broadly. So I try to avoid engaging directly with those challenges by embarking on an analysis that centers around a different definition. And that definition is inspired by the, I would say, unorthodox French Marxist Miguel Abansur, who defined utopianism in very broad terms as, and I quote here, the education of the desire for other ways of being and living. Now, that wide definition captures a great variety of phenomena and experiences, but crucially, it crosses different arenas of social interaction and theory building. So on the one hand, we have the classical utopian theorists that I'm trying to engage with in my book as well. But we also can capture under this broad definition, speculative fiction and narrative art more widely, as well films, as well as books, but also lived experience. So that's the other element that I think this wide definition of the education of a desire for other ways of being and living captures. So what's crucial about this alternative definition that tries to avoid the criticisms that I outlined before is that utopias are not necessarily about perfect blueprints for the future, but they entail an experimental probing and examining of various and sometimes conflicting alternatives for the future. So that's sort of my broad understanding of utopianism that goes beyond merely daydreaming and escapism, but also tries to mitigate the risk of totalitarian world building that is frequently raised by liberal critics of utopianism, for example. So this is the working definition I start with, and then later on in the book, I specify various mechanisms whereby this broad definition can become operative, if you will.
Yeah, can you give an example of a utopia that might fit the model? Because it's a broad definition, but it's also, I mean, it's an interesting idea to think of a utopia as not necessarily an ideal society, which is what we tend to take it. I mean, I've long been a fan of Star Trek. I don't know if this is useful to you, but this is there are some problems with that kind of envisioned society, but it does kind of envision an alternative future, one that's sort of embarked on a kind of Kantian project of perpetual peace. In any case, I'm not sure if that's a useful sort of way to orient in the conversation. If there's another example that you might have to kind of help us here.
Yeah, Star Trek would certainly be a very helpful way of illustrating to us what I'm also interested in. So maybe an example could be taken from the book itself. So I'm trying in the book to reconstruct this particular understanding of utopianism as the education of the desire for other ways of being and living, even in authors who might on the face of it be opposed to utopianism. So the author that perhaps best brings out this ambiguous stance in my book would be the French anthropologist, sociologist, social theorist Bruno Latour, who is on the face of it opposed to all forms of utopianism because he identifies utopianism with precisely the idea of daydreaming, escapism, not facing up to the harsh reality right now. But if we look at his particular rendering of planet Earth as Gaia, and we might have a chance to talk about this in a moment, then I think we can identify in his construction, in his conceptualization, a tendency that mirrors this educational dimension that all utopias bring with them. In this particular context, the pedagogical effort behind Latour's theory building, I think, pertains to the effect of estrangement. So a very important element of these utopias I'm interested in relates to their ability to shed a radically different light on the way how we understand the world right now. And that's usually captured under the a banner of estrangement, an absolutely crucial dimension of utopianism, as I understand it, amongst others, of course. But the example that you pointed out is taken from broadly understood art, the arts and culture. And of course, it would also help us, I think, make sense of this non-perfectionist understanding of utopianism, because the world of Star Trek is held together by some basic principles that you captured with the reference to some form of Kantian cosmopolitanism, perhaps. But it refrains from presenting this world to come as being completely rid of all imperfections and contingencies. It's a world that is full of complexity and contingency. And as such, I think it might also be a good illustration of the kind of non-perfectionist utopianism that I'm trying to reconstruct in my own book.
Yeah, that's good. So before we launch into the particular authors and the particular functions of utopianism that you talk about in the book, I was wondering if you could set the context a little bit in terms of the Anthropocene, which is the particular focus of the types of utopia that you're talking about. You're talking about utopia particularly, as you've mentioned earlier, in the backdrop of climate change. And so particularly those kinds of utopias that are essentially concerned with that issue. Could you talk about the Anthropocene, what it is, and how it relates to the utopian literature that you discuss?
Absolutely. So the Anthropocene is a name we use today to describe a particular geological epoch, sometimes called the Age of the Humans. And it tries to capture an intuition that geologists have pursued for the last 25 odd years, namely that humanity itself has become a geological force, in that it now, that we as humans, the human species now, has a directly observable impact on the atmosphere and the biophysical environment that we all inhabit. As such, the Anthropocene poses very important questions, not only for scientists and for politicians, for concerned citizens, but indeed also for political theorists and those who try to think about the future more broadly. And the way in which I came to this particular context in which I want to pursue my interest in the utopian imagination is really through a interesting observation I came across in Donna Haraway's work. Haraway basically says that there are two big dangers in the current moment as we try to think about how we might be able to inhabit this Anthropocene. One would be the view that we can somehow innovate ourselves through scientific and technological progress out of the ongoing ecological crisis. So that's on one really very widespread, but ultimately, I think, problematic assumption. And the other assumption is that the game is already over, that there's nothing we can do to strive for another, a better, a more just and more sustainable future. And what's interesting in thinking about the Anthropocene then is what happens between these two extreme positions. And my assumption throughout this book is that utopias help us investigate precisely what happens between, on the one hand, the self-assertion that is very, very prominent in techno-utopian discourses around the Anthropocene, and on the other hand, a feeling of defeatism, depression, and ecological mourning that is also quite widespread right now. So the thought is that in this particular moment of crisis, what we need is the utopian imagination, insofar as it manages to avoid both escapism on the one hand, but also defeatism on the other. So this is sort of the ultimate sort of goal of the project, to find out whether I can actually develop a response to Haraway's concern about these twin dangers that I think accompany us in this moment of ecological crisis that is identical with the Anthropocene.
Yeah, that's interesting. It occurs to me there might be a kind of third alternative to either technological ways out or defeatism, which is a sort of, I don't know, a kind of romanticizing of simpler times. You know, a way in which there, you know, one response, I think, to climate change has been to understand a more kind of authentic or simpler relationship to the earth. I'm looking ahead to the Atwood trilogy, and in any case, which we'll talk about it in a minute. But I'm not sure what you think of that. And I mean, in terms of, because it seems to me that at least there's some utopian literature that thinks about navigating these poles by thinking about kind of a, you know, sustainability and a more sort of a relationship of humans to the earth that's more sustainable.
Absolutely, that's one of the driving intuitions behind my proposal as well. The utopias I'm interested in the book can be characterized by a very particular feature, namely they are sustainable in a particular sense. They are this-worldly. That's what I want to say. These are this-worldly utopias. Maybe a somewhat paradoxically sounding concept, but the basic assumption here is that these are all visions of the future that presuppose that Earth is all our species will ever have. So this is not about escaping from this planet, it's about making this planet a better home, not only for humans, but for all the other species that inhabit it. So I agree with you that the way forward is precisely to think creatively about radically reconfiguring our relationships with the environment. That can go in a direction that you described through more interest in perhaps sustainable ways of living. Degrowth would be another interesting political concept that has gained quite a bit of notoriety in recent times. So all of those ideas, I think, can be captured under this umbrella term of this world, the utopias that are really at the center of my attention in the book.
Good. So can you say a little bit? I mean, you have a nice kind of elegant scheme of setting up the three different types of utopian literature that you discuss. And the sort of three different functions of them, that one type of utopia estranges us, one type of utopia galvanizes us, and one type of utopia, or perhaps dystopia, cautions us. Maybe you could just talk about that scheme, how you could kind of arrived at it, and sort of flesh it out a little bit for us.
Yes, thank you so much. Indeed. So I thought working with this broad definition of the education of the desire for other ways of being and living enables us to get a better grasp of a really wide variety of stories and of theories. But what is needed if we want to vindicate this idea that utopianism is necessary for our times is a clearer understanding of the specific mechanisms of the radical imagination proposed by utopians. So the model that I developed is really an inductively developed model through reading the novels and to thinking about the various functions that others have already talked about, is tripartite, as you said. The first function that utopias perform is estrangement. We have already talked about that just now. So utopias try to estrange us, defamiliarize us from the status quo by presenting us with radically different worlds. So the effect of these estrangement devices is always to invite the reader to see the world from new and unexpected angles, and the purpose of this particular estrangement effect is always critique, of course. So utopias are at the same time and always about other worlds, but they are also always about this world at which the critical gaze is directed. So I take this notion of estrangement from the literary theorist Svetlana Boym, who distinguishes very interestingly, I think, between estrangement from the world and estrangement for the world. So the first kind of estrangement from the world can be problematic, and indeed it is the objection to utopianism as escapist that brings out this estrangement from the world dimension. So for example, in the current crisis, I think that narratives of escaping from planet Earth estrange us from the world in a problematic manner. So when tech billionaires like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos fantasize about such escape, they are engaged in utopian thinking, but the effect of these projects on the imagination is one that I would consider problematic. So I'm interested in estrangement for the world, and that's why I'm interested in this worldly utopias that help us navigate the complexity of the Anthropocene on this planet, or not on Mars or any other planet that Musk had envisaged. So estrangement is crucial for all of the utopias I'm interested in. But a particular subset of utopias is especially concerned with galvanizing an audience. So what do I mean here? The classical positive visions of the futures, e-utopias, always try to inflate our perception of what the current status quo still holds in terms of promise for a different future. Galvanizing is particularly important in a moment like now, when more and more people, I believe, sense that the game is already over. And utopias then can try to demonstrate to us in practice that humankind is much more capable of solving complex problems and ultimately inaugurating a good Anthropocene, not just any Anthropocene, than we would normally think. So galvanizing is the classical effect that positive visions of the future try to exert on an audience. Finally, working with my broad definition taken from Abensur, cautioning is a very important dimension of utopias as well. So these stories of environmental breakdown I'm working on in the book try to unearth from within the current moment dangerous trends that might develop into catastrophic apocalyptic even breakdowns. So we already talked a moment ago about Atwood a little bit. So these three functions, estranging, galvanizing, and cautioning, are to different degrees present in all the utopias I'm interested in, but I pick out elements and stories as well as theories from the wide range of utopias that are circulating right now that exemplify these three functions particularly well in each of the core chapters of the book.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it seems to me that the estrangement function is in a, I mean, it's great, good that you begin there, because it seems in a way a kind of necessary condition for all the others, right? In the sense that in order to galvanize or to caution, we need to have become in some way estranged from the current condition in order to develop our desires in a particular way or not. So you see, I mean, do you see these different functions as sort of mutually informing one another, or supportive, or at odds with one another? I think I know that we'll talk about the limits of each you know form of utopian thinking, but just in terms of the educative function of these, do you see them as mainly mutually supportive or mainly at odds with one another?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. All three functions or mechanisms are present in all utopias in one way or another, at least in the utopias I'm interested in. Certainly, the estrangement effect is central to all forms of speculative fiction, because it is one of the underlying motivations behind this kind of fiction, that we can indeed imagine other worlds, and that gives us a different perspective on the world we're currently inhabiting, and thereby we might be induced to change the way how we currently live together, and so we become educated towards different ways of living and being. Galvanizing and cautioning are also present in most utopias, certainly in the utopias I'm interested in, but some utopias put the emphasis particularly strongly on one of those three mechanisms. And again, when I surveyed the current debate, I was looking for exemplarily strong articulations of one of those three dimensions. But I would certainly say, just like you, that they are mutually reinforcing of one another, even if particular authors put the emphasis on one element rather than on another.
Great. So let's talk about the first type, the estranging form of utopia. You call this the what if type of utopia, which is interesting. Envisioning sort of possibilities that could arouse the imagination. The focus in the chapter is about, I guess, imagining what if planet Earth were sort of a living creature, as it were. This is, you mentioned earlier, the Gaia hypothesis, which is a kind of classical old hypothesis, but has been kind of retooled by Bruno Latour, whom you also just mentioned. So maybe we could start there. And then in the second part of the chapter, you talk about N.K. Jemisin, who's a very well-known science fiction author, and her Broken Earth trilogy sort of envisions cities and the planet as living things. So talk about what's going on there, but maybe we'd talk to start with the Gaia hypothesis and maybe discuss about what you draw from that for your theory of this type of utopia.
Absolutely. So as you said, the first utopian constellation I'm interested in revolves around this idea of estrangement, and talking about the theory pole of the utopian imagination, so the political theorists, social theorists who are engaged in that kind of project, I focus on the so-called Gaia theory. Now, what is the Gaia theory? This, as you said, in fact, an old idea, but was revived by James Lovelock, who was an inventor, engineer, and scientist, who is today, despite many other things he has done in his long life, best known for developing this theory of Gaia. The theory itself went through different iterations, and I need to simplify here, but in essence, Gaia describes an understanding of planet Earth as composed of interdependent feedback loops that form a self-regulating system. So what that means is that organisms, living organisms, are entangled with their environment, and together they create the conditions for continuing life on the planet itself. This view of life led Lovelock to conclude that Gaia, a complex entity that involves the Earth's biosphere, the atmosphere, the oceans, the soil, itself is somehow alive. So the planet is somehow alive. Gaia is alive. What this system does is it seeks an optimal physical and chemical environment for life on this planet. So the planet is alive to enable continuing life for all its organisms. Now, why am I interested in this particular vision of the planet? Partly because the French sociologist and social theorist Bruno Latour took up this idea in a series of lectures at my home university in 2013 in Edinburgh, where he tried to use the Gaia figure for investigating the implications that the Anthropocene has for society and politics today. So what the Gaia hypothesis for Latour ultimately amounts to is a view of the social as well as the natural world, in which no one is passive. So everyone is active, everything is active, even the planet is active and alive in some interesting way. So agency, the ability to act, is much more widely distributed than one would normally assume, especially if one wishes to assign a special status to our own human species. Yeah? So it's absolutely not surprising that one of the stalwarts of so-called actor network theory felt very attracted and interested in Lovelock's idea of Gaia, precisely because of this universal dispersion of agency across different forms of being. So the understanding of a living planet raises important challenges, not just for science, and Lovelock was throughout his life faced with severe hostility from the scientific establishment, but also for politics and society more general. So Latour calls this the new climate regime, the ways in which the Anthropocene, or Gaia, if you will, poses unique challenges for political actors and for citizens as much as for scientists who want to understand how Gaia actually functions. So in a very interesting book, Down to Earth, which is a continuation in some ways of his Gaia hypothesis book, Latour tries to argue that we now inhabit an era in which humanity needs to contend and argue with the planet, not just to subjugate it, as we have traditionally done in order to extract resources and to exploit the Earth, but we need to find some form of peace with the planet. And that is based on his understanding of Gaia as a living planet. So what that means, of course, ultimately, and here we get to the estrangement effect that I'm interested in, it leads not only to a different view of the planet, but it also leads to a different view of what human agency might mean. It is essentially unsettles anthropocentric views of society and politics that Latour associates very much with the modern condition. And we have now moved into a different era in which the planet and everything else is active. And that means we need to position ourselves as human beings in carefully different ways than we had done before.
Good. So is this view, am I right to think that it's a sort of contrast to you could say a modern scientific technological view that understands nature or the earth as, I guess as Heidegger put it, standing reserve. It's just sort of, you know, passive matter that's there for our manipulation and control. In contrast, we should think about the natural world as active rather than passive in nature. And I assume the other sort of purpose of this is a metaphor we're talking about, not like the world is not truly alive, but it's a metaphor that there's a kind of interdependent character on the part of, agents in the world, such that it redounds back on our agency if we kind of mess too much with the interdependent character of the natural earth, the natural world's agency. Does that sort of pick at the kind of motivation and the character of the of what
that's
he's
exactly
after?
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly the point I think that he wants to make, in as much as he wants to say that once you realize that we don't have access to a passive repertoire of resources that we can simply exploit, we also need to abandon the dream of mastering the planet. Right? So it's a critique of a certain vision of the future in which humans become assertive and competent earth makers, if you will, who control the planet in order to avert the worst outcomes of the Anthropocene. So if you will, in very practical terms, and this gets us back to the vision that Haraway is so critical of, it's a very, very, I think, trenchant critique of ideas like geoengineering, for example, whereby humans manage to control the planet by regulating the temperature on it. If you really subscribe to the Gaia hypothesis, then you would have to abandon these delusional fantasies, because humans are much too closely and inextricably intertwined with their own environment for us to step outside of those relationships and control the planet in these technological ways. Maybe just one other thing to add here, because you just talked about Gaia as a metaphor, Jeffrey. For someone like Lovelock, that would probably be have been some sort of offense, because he did not think it was a metaphor. He believed in the actual science behind Gaia, and that caused so much of the, I think, ire of the scientific establishment. Now, of course, Latour and the social theorists engaging with this idea indeed, I think, draw on a much more metaphorical interpretation here. But the original idea is one that tries to defend the Gaia hypothesis on scientific grounds. I'm a political theorist, so I'm not competent to assess the quality and the plausibility of those claims. But if I understand correctly, then Lovelock meant the Gaia hypothesis to entail an entirely scientific understanding of the planet.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Well, apologies to the Gaia believers out there. Certainly don't want to offend. Let's shift over to the N.K. Jemisin, the literature here, because you draw on, you know, again, a well-known trilogy, sci-fi trilogy, as a sort of to express, illustrate this point in quite an interesting way. It's been on my reading list for a while, as I told you, I think several months ago we said it, but I still haven't read it. So I'll have to rely on your kind of summary of the overall picture of the book. So maybe if you could give us just the brief capsule summary of the trilogy, and what you take to be its contribution here to this type of utopian thinking.
Absolutely. And I can just repeat that you should really read those three books. It's a fantastic example of politically generative and exciting science fiction and fantasy. So N.K. Jemisin, who won various awards for that trilogy and for other books recently written, approaches many of the themes that Latour raises, but does so from a unique angle, I think, in her so-called Broken Earth trilogy. So this is a trilogy set in a fantasy world in which humans have various capacities, you know, including magical capacities that allow them to manipulate the Earth. In this fantasy world, humans contend, struggle, and ultimately reconcile themselves with their existence on our planet, what Jemisin calls Father Earth. Now, that's a planet in the far future that is heavily disturbed by climatic catastrophes and geological catastrophes that humans and other beings try to grapple with. Importantly, for my understanding of utopias, this is a far future narrative. So that's not a narrative set in the close, nearby future, but in the far future, with a few key, I think, features that might be interesting for political theorists working on utopias. So first of all, it portrays a very tight-knit intergenerational group of survivors of environmental disaster. So that gets us back to the intertwining of estrangement and cautioning, for example. At the heart of the entire trilogy is a story about environmental breakdown caused by humans. The home planet of our species, Earth, is portrayed as a living being, as a raging being that rebels against injustice, and that also enacts brutal retaliation for the harm done to it by humans. So this brings us back to the parallel with the Gaia figure. The planet, Father Earth, in Jemisin's diction, tries to take revenge for the injustice done to it. And then the third and perhaps most interesting feature of the trilogy, on my account, is Jemisin's very perspicacious understanding of violence amongst humans, as well as between humans and other species. Because Jamison thinks, and this is, I think, inspired by her very, I think, erudite interpretation of the Haitian Revolution, for example, she thinks of violence as cyclical in nature and is always amounting to backlash. So violence usually, even when pursued in the with the goal of liberating oneself from injustice, usually creates more violence. And the challenge really for those of us who have to inhabit this planet, Father Earth, is how we may break out of this cycle of violence, especially when we cope not only with other humans, but with more than human beings as well. So what is the solution for Jamison in this trilogy? It is some form of interpersonal and even interspecies solidarity. Solidarity provides an effective antidote to the devastations wrought by oppressive institutions, structures, and persons. Now, interpreting the trilogy from the perspective of the education of the desire for other ways of being is so interesting, I think, because the trilogy really demolishes a very dominant trope in science fiction, and that's sort of the lone wolf trope. That you know, when the apocalypse comes, then you know, very few will survive, and only the most capable, usually male, survivors will be the ones that succeed. So Jamison's view is entirely different one. It emphasizes the importance of group improvisation and group solidarity. And it also entails, I think, a very strong critique of white masculinity, if you will, which is sort of the real focus of her challenging alternative description of solidarity. So this universe, this fantasy land, is premised on the existence of ineradicable and ongoing conflicts between various parties, again, a bit like Gaia. And what it does, I think, is it throws an entirely surprising light on how we conceive life on planet Earth here and now. Yeah? By trying to show to us a fantasy world in which Father Earth itself can become an agent, and vindictive and vengeful agent, I think Jamison wants us to think differently about injustices and oppressive structures here and now on this planet. And that's sort of the typical double move that all utopias perform. They estrange us from this world, but then they bring us back to engaging with what we are actually living through. So there's an interesting structural similarity, I believe, or that's the wager on which this book rides, between Latour's appropriation of the Gaia figure and N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy, which picks up many similar themes, but of course transforms them into a more speculative fiction register.
That's great. Why do you think that she chooses Father Earth? I mean, the rather than Mother Earth, obviously, is the more common Gaia type of, you know, resonance, the sort of caring mother who, you know, nurtures the children and the children rebel against her. Does this have to do with the sort of violence, cycles of violence that you're mentioning? Why do you think she chose Father?
Yeah, I think it is precisely that, to sort of disabuse us of the illusion that we could have this naturally harmonious relationship with the planet. What she demonstrates, I think, in the trilogy is that if we were to establish more sustainable relationships, the ones that you talked about at the beginning of our conversation, then we need to properly argue and contend with the planet. And that is a sort of more paternal relationship, perhaps, that that she captures through the name Father Earth. I suppose it's also just you know, one of those descriptions that makes you think again. Why does she say Father Earth rather than Mother Earth? A name that we are maybe much more accustomed to. But on my reading, it emphasizes precisely the conflictual, violent dimension of our engagement with the planet that is not so much emphasized in the maternal epithet, Mother Earth.
Fantastic. So the second type of utopian literature, the one that galvanizes our desires, you call this the if only. The first one was the what if type of utopia. This is the if only. So the nice kind of kick capsule bumper sticker version there of this type. This envisions a kind of the grand possibilities of scientific and technological progress. The focus in this chapter is on an organization called the Breakthrough Institute, and then you discuss Kim Stanley Robinson's Science and the Capital trilogy. So maybe you could you could start in the same way. We could talk about the theory in general, and then move on to the literature to illustrate this type.
Yes. So this if only constellation, focused on galvanizing, I think can be very helpfully illustrated through a focus on eco-modernism, very broadly construed. And that's a largely optimistic view, according to which we humans can become confident earth makers, right? So the interpretation of the Anthropocene here is one in which our species' ingenuity is really at the center of attention. Very important, I think, for interpreting eco-modernism is that it is a relatively broad church movement that can include both right-wing and left-wing thinkers and writers. So this is not just a right-wing movement. There are quite a few left-wing thinkers as well who are attracted to the eco-modernist vision. So a couple of key ideas that characterize this vision that, as you said already, was first clearly articulated by the Breakthrough Institute, an American think tank, in 2015. First of all, economic or population growth per se is not the problem. The problem is with pollution and the outputs of the economic system, not the economic system per se. Relatedly, economic stability is a precondition for any effective environmental action. So degrowth would be excluded from that vision from the get-go. Why? Because developmental aspects of growth are absolutely necessary, even if this leads to increased fossil fuel use. So what, again, back to the problem of pollution. It's the use itself is not the problem, the pollution is the problem. And finally, an important aspect of eco-modernism is its heavy reliance on a range of metaphors and rhetorical figures, such as, for example, decoupling resource systems from human needs, that project a very specific vision of humanity and its place on the planet. So the manifesto published by the Breakthrough Institute really argues that we can inaugurate a good Anthropocene, an Anthropocene in which humanity prevails, if only we harness the power of science and technology to decouple human from environmental development. And this will, of course, require groundbreaking science and technology, such as, most emblematically, geoengineering, but also carbon capture projects. But importantly, we already possess the basic know-how how to establish those mechanisms of geoengineering and carbon capture. That's at least the claim made prominently by eco-modernists. So if you were to look another spokesperson for this particular understanding of our shared future, you could look at Steven Pinker, for example, of recent fame through his bestseller, The Better Angels of Our Nature. He would be a typical liberal representative of this particular type of eco-modernism. And on this view, modernity and capitalism are forces of good that have recently just received bad press. And we need to sort of recover what is so good about capitalism if we want to really solve the ecological crisis. So progress, and this is part of any utopian project, progress is not only possible, it is also already much more pronounced than doom mongers and those who are trying to instill fear and anxiety in us want us to believe. So what's really problematic from this perspective that Pinker, for example, I think tries to pursue is that some forms of environmentalism point in the completely wrong direction. So, for example, degrowth, the kind of vision you talked about before, trying to establish more sustainable ways of life, is really the wrong approach because it calls into question the basic underpinnings of capitalist modernity, if you will. So this is a sort of more right-wing liberal vision, perhaps, but on the left as well, there are a lot of thinkers who believe in the compossibility of economic growth and the robust response to the ecological crisis. Again, on the left, there's a variety of positions ranging from those who wish to strengthen the state as the motor behind the Green New Deal, for example, an important debate in the United States, but also to those who prefer a much more bottom-up environmentalism led by social movements and who would actually be very critical of the great project of a Green New Deal. So what all of those positions share, from Pinker to some of the authors I engage with publishing in the Jacobin magazine, for example, what all they share is a general affective state of hope vis-a-vis the future. So while they recognize with varying degrees the severity of the ecological crisis, eco-modernists try to inflate the potential that the future still holds for us. That's why I talk about this inflationary education of our desire. So the purpose, as you already pointed out, Jeffrey, is to galvanize an audience that has become apathetic or depressed or paralyzed by the constant onslaught of bad news about the future. Yeah? So what's interesting then, and maybe we talk about it in a moment, is that there will always be traces of wishful thinking in these particular depictions of the future. Why? Because ultimately they have to inflate our understanding of what's going on by allowing for the redemptive sort of potential of scientific and technological progress to come out in full as we think about the future.
Right. Yeah. And this is interesting because it strikes me as that it includes a kind of wide variety of different understandings of human capacities in this type. I was thinking initially when you first started talking that this is the kind of polar opposite of the first type that you had mentioned, the Jemison approach, that is, you know, it envisions a kind of limitless human possibility, which certainly could be one possibility of this utopian thinking. But on the other hand, it could be a version that kind of combines both, where say certainly on the approach that seems to be on the left, or the Green New Deal, as you mentioned, which is a kind of combination of sustainable living with the use of technology to kind of mitigate some of the worst excesses that humanity has created. So I don't know, you know, in terms of thinking about this kind of broad church of different types within it, if that's on target in terms of thinking about human capacities and very different understandings of human capacities within the kind of wishful thinking that exists.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are very important gradations of this particular if only utopian vision, and it makes a great deal of difference where you stand on questions of the Green New Deal, for example, and how you would actually design such a grand scheme for a good Anthropocene. But I would still maybe insist that there is some important categorical difference between the first and the second type. And that difference has to do with the unsettling or the reconstituting of human supremacy. So the first type of the Gaia hypothesis and the universe and fantasy land that Jemison imagined, I think really prompts the reader to consider how would a world look like in which our species is not in control. Whatever we do, we are trying to find some ways of settling our debts and settling our relationship with our environment in new ways. But we need to abandon this fantasy of control, if you will. So that's sort of the classic. That's what's interesting about this non-anthropocentric utopian vision that we talked about just before. Now, The second type, the if only type of eco-modernism, tries to re-establish the idea of human control over nature with various degrees of emphasis, of course. As you say, you know, there are those who try to rein in human impulses to master the planet. And then there are those who believe straightforwardly that we can fully you know, control the planet and regulate the temperatures through geoengineering, etc., etc. It's a broad church movement. But I think the difference here is, nevertheless, even those who try to rein in human impulses, who perhaps argue even for a degrowth to some degree, would still insist on the principled assumption of human mastery. And there's a difference here, I think, with the first type. But when we talk about Robinson, I think in a moment perhaps we can see how this is played out in more concrete terms.
Yeah, so why don't we turn to that Kim Stanley Robinson's science in the Capital trilogy, also books on my list. You've given me lots of good books to read. I have read Margaret Atwood, whom we'll talk about in a second, so I have more things to say about her. But go ahead, tell us about Robinson's trilogy.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm assuming your listeners will know Robinson. He's maybe now really the most important political novelist in the US. I think it's not an exaggeration to say that the recent success with his Ministry of the Future was really a breakthrough, I think, for his reputation. But as you know, he has long been preoccupied with utopian projects and with climate change more widely. He's an early proponent and important contributor to so-called climate fiction. The focus in my book is on a trilogy that predates the Ministry of the Future. It's the so-called Science in the Capital trilogy that you can today also buy in an abridged version under the title Green Earth. So what Robinson does in this trilogy is he tries to probe the utopian credentials of a scientific community that has become immunized against capitalist co-optation and willing to mount political struggles against climate change. So the real hero of this trilogy, and that's what makes it a very interesting and somewhat eccentric book perhaps, is in fact the National Science Foundation in the US, the NSF. And what the trilogy does, it locates the motor behind progressive politics and progressive action in a state-sponsored organization that funds and distributes and coordinates technological innovations through the Science Foundation. So in an interesting way, this is really a bureaucratic utopia. It's a close future vision of Washington. Washington DC is fully recognizable as Washington DC. But at its heart is the only slightly estranged version of the National Science Foundation. And the argument is that the ecological crisis that we're grappling with can be tackled if and only if scientists, who are the central motors of change here, take their political responsibilities very seriously indeed. And on the other hand, if politicians start properly engaging with scientists. So there are a couple of key ideas in this trilogy, a very long trilogy as well. First of all, as we already pointed out, Robinson in this trilogy really venerates bureaucratic modes of doing politics. Yeah? So this is not really about democracy as sort of an important motor behind effective and just environmental politics. It's about bureaucratic and even technocratic ways of doing politics. And the thought is that only some sort of marriage between science and progressive politics can actually save us from the Anthropocene. Secondly, he also has some interesting thoughts about the interdependence between science and spirituality. Yeah? So rationality alone for Robinson is a dead end. Rationality needs to be complemented with an understanding of the spiritual dimension of our being. So the climate crisis also requires some sort of spiritual awakening. It's not only about the science alone. And then finally, perhaps the most interesting discussion, and that brings us back to this idea of utopias as non-perfectionist, Robinson explores multiple pathways out of the impending catastrophe. So there are no silver bullets. There are some attempts at grand geoengineering in the trilogy, but there are also attempts to change your life on the micro level of how you behave, how you relate to your immediate loved ones. One of the key actors and key figures in the book tries to completely re-paleolithicize his life. So he tries to become a paleolithic human again. And that's an example of, you know, how we might inhabit Anthropocene as well. But the most important, I think, thought of the whole trilogy is really that decoupling is possible, but only if science becomes decoupled from capitalism. So there's a very strong anti-capitalist strand in the book that continues in the Ministry of the Future, and is sort of one of the key features of Robinson's thinking in general.
Can you say more?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sorry to interrupt. I was just the idea of the spirituality feature of this is quite interesting. I mean, maybe you could say a little bit more about that in terms of, is this, does he think that the spirituality is crucial in order precisely to prevent the kind of co-optation of capitalism into science in order to keep science pure? Or is it, you know, in other words, continue to orient science towards the truth and to higher aspirations? Or is it to limit the kind of ambitions or hubris of science, or maybe a little all of both?
I think it's a little bit of both, but certainly the limitations that spirituality can impose on science are very strongly foregrounded through a long interaction between one of the key figures in the novel with a group of Buddhist monks. And those Buddhist monks, in particular one of them, teaches one of those scientists that the scientific instrumental rationality that underpins the very solution that we are striving for is by itself always at risk of destroying its material underpinnings. So spirituality is precisely important to rein in the sort of excessive nature of instrumental rationality. And Robinson tries to explore in a somewhat playful manner how a very single-minded scientist might become affected by the perspective of, you know, a number of Buddhist monks who actually share many of the insights about how humans relate to the environment with those scientists, but who don't believe in the importance of capitalism and the sort of consumerist society that characterizes Washington, D.C. in this near future depiction. So both of those elements are there, but spirituality is absolutely crucial for the eco-modernism that Robinson has in mind to function.
That's great. So let's move on to the final type of utopian thinking, maybe dystopian thinking. This is a sort of bleaker vision. If this goes on type of dystopia. It's the dystopia that educates our desires to cautioning, to being cautious. In a way, it strikes me as this is kind of might think of the most common form of utopian/dystopian literature around nowadays. That is, you know, you turn on Netflix or whatever, and every third movie is about some kind of climate catastrophe. Do you think that's true? Or I mean, when I guess maybe before we get into it, have you thought about the sort of relative popularity of these three different types, and which you think is most popular and why?
You're absolutely right. I mean, you just have to turn on the TV and I mean, dystopia is absolutely everywhere, and it says a lot about, you know, our sort of current moment that the most prominent ways of thinking about the future are shaped by this dystopian sensibility. Someone like Robinson, I think, consciously writes against this tendency. So he's somebody who has written about the preponderance of dystopian imaginaries by arguing that, yeah, we need to struggle against that, against the dystopian impulse, and think about positive visions, right? And I can see that point, and it's certainly true that it seems to be much harder to at least make money with utopias than with dystopias. Otherwise, we wouldn't be watching so many dystopian shows on Netflix and other platforms. But I also think that dystopias are indeed very important right now. These negative, pessimistic visions can perform a very important function. But it's maybe not one that especially progressive commentators are happy to accept. So very frequently, these negative, pessimistic visions are associated with defeatism, right? And a certain sense of, we're just giving up and we're thinking about what happens after the breakdown rather than trying to still work towards a more just and sustainable future. So I want to pursue a slightly different understanding in this chapter by saying that, yeah, the function that these dystopias perform is a complicated one.
Good. Yeah. So maybe you could walk us through, you know, how you think, because this trilogy, man, Atwood's Mad Atom trilogy is indeed a complicated one that involves multiple different characters, sort of who all converge ultimately in the third book. So how do you think that she sort of contributes to this and avoids the defeatist worry about this type of dystopian thinking?
Yeah, so just to repeat what we talked about at the start, the main function of these utopias is to caution us, right? So to kind of warn us about impending disaster. And what's interesting about Atwood's work and her Mad Atom trilogy, that is the focus of this final chapter, is that she has not only written various very interesting dystopian and utopian novels, but she has also reflected on the nature of social dreaming or utopianism itself. And one of her key convictions in this book and throughout her writing more generally is that utopias and dystopias are always entangled with one another. So they contain within themselves their respective negations. In other words, every utopia contains within it already dystopian elements and vice versa. So she coined this new term, which I don't know how to pronounce, either as astopia or utopia, where she tries to say, you know, we need to have some sort of new understanding of dystopia and utopia as being composed in equal terms of its negation. So what I try to argue in the book is that this Mad Atom trilogy is really a very good example of such an astopia or utopia. So that story tells, the trilogy tells the story of a small group of humans who survive a global pandemic induced by a mad scientist. And that pandemic has wiped out almost the entire species. Now, the three books move back and forth between a storyline that explains the unfolding catastrophe and what led to the breakdown of human civilization, and the second storyline that depicts how the surviving humans build a common future with other species who have also survived. Now, what the trilogy does, I think, very powerfully and convincingly, is that it visualizes the apocalypse not only as the catastrophic end of an era, but also as an opportunity for pondering what might lie beyond the Anthropocene. So again, it mixes together in, I think, very illustrative ways, positive and negative visions of the future. So there are three sort of key features that I foreground in my analysis and interpretation. The first of all is that the apocalypse can actually disclose routes towards new beginnings. So this is not a purely defeatist vision of the present, even though it is an incredibly bleak read, especially the first volume. I'm curious what you think, Jeffrey, but the first one I found really hard to finish. The second feature is that the storytelling becomes more and more polyphonic. It's not just about one perspective, the human perspective in this trilogy. The more we go through these three books, the more we realize that humanity has sort of lost control over the voice through which the story of the Anthropocene and the aftermath of the Anthropocene is narrated. So humanity is not a homogeneous actor when grappling with the climate changed world. There are many other actors that are also trying to tell that story. And finally, the third point, and that resonates very much with Jamieson's interpretation of interspecies solidarity, Atwood also thematizes a form of sociality that is non-anthropocentric. So after the breakdown, humans have to negotiate their place within a completely new landscape composed of human and non-human hybrids. Now, again, I'm very curious what you think, but I think satire and humor play a very important role in these three books. And that is, again, an interesting element, I think, of those complicated forms of dystopian imagination. I think Atwood wants to remind us that, even though things are incredibly bleak, there are ways in which we can move beyond the current impasse that will make us laugh and perhaps cry at the same time. And that is sort of the interesting, very, I think, moving story that we can derive from this trilogy.
Yes, I think that's a great, you have a great analysis here. I think it is the sort of a bleak trilogy, especially the first book. I mean, one of the things that makes it bleak, I think, in particular, the first book is the question that it raises, which is about, she's getting us to ask the question seriously about the goodness of humanity's occupation of the earth itself. Whether human beings and human nature, whether we're sort of inherently destructive of our habitation on the planet, that we're sort of inherently power hungry and we greedy and seek dominance and mastery and so forth. And so there's the creation of these creatures who are meant to, by that scientist who kills, who introduces a virus, introduction of these creatures called the Krakers, who are meant to exist without the kind of reflection about death and exist in perpetual harmony with the earth. And there's sort of resonances of Plato's Republic and Rousseau's sort of creatures in the state of nature. But interestingly, as the novel goes on, it seems to me, I agree with you. There's a way in which Atwood is trying to make a case, nevertheless, for the value of humanity in, either the satire that exists, or I'm curious what maybe you could elaborate on the point about spirituality. So much of the second book is about the survival of a group of religious believers who kind of sustain themselves after the apocalypse, which is not characteristic of the Krakers, though it's kind of introduced in an interesting way to them. So I'm not sure if you want to speak to what her view of the value of humanity and the role of spirituality here in her trilogy.
Yeah, it's really an interesting question that I probably am not most competent to answer, but there are those in the literature on Atwood and on dystopian fiction more widely who I think associate her pretty straightforwardly with some kind of misanthropy. So as you just said, especially in the first book of the trilogy, one cannot really get away from an impression of mankind, humankind, as being just ontologically destructive. And there's no way of redemption for our species. And hence, we are sort of on this one-way route towards self-explosion and destruction, if you will, through this pandemic that is engineered by one of those mad scientists. But as we progress in the trilogy, I think her misanthropy softens somewhat, and she does indeed explore possibilities of communal living. You refer to this community, this intentional community called the God's Gardeners, who try to imagine more sustainable ways of living. But even there, her depiction of this intentional utopian community is very ambivalent and ambiguous. So it's not straightforwardly a good thing that these God's Gardeners try to save just themselves and don't really care about anyone else. So in one way, we could think of this intentional community as a community of preppers who are preparing for the breakdown and then just want to save themselves without thinking too much about the wider society that they are part of. Like everything that Atwood does, I think it is shot through with satire and tongue-in-cheek claims. But I think it makes you think about these big questions of, you know, are humans, for example, as I said before, according to Atwood, ontologically destructive and not capable of finding the kind of peace that Latour, for example, wants us to search for in our contention with Gaia? Or are there other ways of being that are more utopian and more straightforwardly positive? So I'm not 100% sure, but I'm very glad to hear that you had similar impressions of the novel as being ambivalent and in some ways undecided about this.
Yeah, I taught Oryx and Crake when it in an undergraduate class when it around when it came out, and I asked my students one day, and get your take on this. There's a moment in Oryx and Crake where there's a technological development such that, let me see if I can remember correctly, that scientists sort of geoengineer chickens that don't have brains. Right. So they can't feel pain, but they have, you know, like eight legs and, you know, extremely large breasts, you know, precisely in order to harvest them and eat them so you can feed vast swaths of humanity. And the chicken can't feel pain. Right. So I asked this, you know, and obviously it's a great, great satire. So great moment of what you're talking about. But I asked the students, the chicken that's produced out of them are called chicky nubs, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. The students, so would you eat a chicky nub? And, you know, I can't say that half the students raised their hands, but there was a vocal minority that said they would eat up those chicky nubs.
Interesting. I'll try the same experiment with my class next term.
So that's great. Let me conclude, because we're pretty much out of time, just by asking kind of a general question to you in conclusion, if you want to sort of draw together, you know, based on what you have learned about utopian literature, what you think to be the role or the possible value and role of utopian thinking for contemporary society.
Yeah, thank you. So looking back at the research for this book and at my own experience of thinking about these questions, I think there's one narrow response and then a more wider response. The narrow response is about the discipline of political theory. So I felt it extremely liberating to try to read those novels I ultimately selected for the purpose of analysis as texts that are interesting for political theory. Even though they might not necessarily appear as such, especially Jamieson's work, I don't think has been widely received yet in political theory circles. Robinson and Atwood, maybe a little bit more. But I wanted to argue that you know, it's not only the sort of established canon of high literature, you know, that has played an important role, for example, in the thinking of Richard Rorty, Martha Nussbaum, Judith Butler. But we can also turn to this, you know, more impure forms of speculative fiction to inform our discussion around important questions in political theory. So I think there's a lot to be learned there. And I hope in my future work to widen my interest even more in that direction. And then, the wider response to your question is, in some ways, I think there is almost no alternative to utopianism right now, precisely because the challenges we are facing of such magnitude that business as usual is simply no option anymore, we will be drawn one way or another to these radical forms of imagining the future. And what is needed then is a careful judgment of the kind of radical imagination that hopefully lead us indeed to a more just and sustainable future, and those forms of radical imagination that lead us astray. So I think what's called upon then in the end is critical judgment, as always, different forms of utopianism. And my understanding of this anti-perfectionist, flexible method of immanently criticizing the status quo is hopefully one way in which this debate can be organized fruitfully. There will be others, but that's at least the one that I pursued in this book.
Great. Well, Matthias, thank you so much. This has been really a very enjoyable conversation. And so thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for your questions, and I look forward to many other episodes from you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.